Part 2. The Darkest Part of the Night. Title: One Forgotten Night. Artist: Samantha Benning. Date: 2014. Medium: acrylic on canvas over wood. Location: on loan from the Lizette Price Gallery, New York City. Description: a largely monochromatic piece, paint layered into a topography of black, charcoals, and grays. Seven small white dots stand out against the backdrop. Background: known largely on its own, this painting also serves as the frontispiece for an ongoing series titled I Look Up to You, in which Benning imagines family, friends, and lovers as different iterations of the sky. Estimated value: $11,500. New York City, March 12, 2014. 1. Henry Strauss heads back into the shop. Bee's taken up residence again in the battered leather chair, the glossy art book open in her lap. Where did you go? He looks back through the open door and frowns. Nowhere. She shrugs, turning through the pages, a guide to neoclassical art that she has no intention of buying. Not a library. Henry sighs, returning to the till. Sorry, he says to the girl by the counter. Where were we? She bites her lip. Her name is Emily, he thinks.
I was about to ask you if you wanted to grab a drink.
He laughs a little nervously, a habit he's beginning to think he'll never shake. She's pretty, she really is, but there's the troublesome shine in her eyes, a familiar milky light, and he's relieved he doesn't have to lie about having plans tonight.
Another time, she says with a smile.
Another time, he echoes as the girl takes her book and goes. The door has barely closed when Bee clears her throat. What? He asks without turning. You could have gotten her number. We have plans, he says, tapping the tickets on the counter. He hears the soft stretch of leather as she rises from the chair.
You know, she says, swinging an arm around his shoulder, the great thing about plans is that you can make them for other days, too.
He turns, hands rising to her waist, and now they're locked like kids in the throes of a school dance, limbs making wide circles like nets or chains.
Beatrice Helen, he scolds.
Henry Samuel.
They stand there, in the middle of the store, two 20-somethings in a preteen embrace. And maybe once upon a time, Bee would have leaned a little harder, made some speech about finding someone new, about deserving to be happy again. But they have a deal. She doesn't mention Tabitha, and Henry doesn't mention the professor. Everyone has their fallen foes, their battle scars.
Excuse me, says an older man, sounding genuinely sorry to interrupt.
He holds up a book, and Henry smiles and breaks the chain, ducking back behind the counter to ring him up. Bee swipes her ticket from the table and says she'll meet him at the show, and Henry nods her off, and the old man goes on his way, and the rest of the afternoon is a quiet blur of pleasant strangers. He turns the sign over at 5 to 6 and goes through the motions of closing the shop. The last word isn't his, but it might as well be. It's been weeks since he saw the actual owner, Meredith, who's spending her golden years traveling the world on her late husband's life insurance, a fall woman indulging in a second spring. Henry scoops a handful of kibble into the small red dish behind the counter for Book, the shop's ancient cat, and a moment later, a ratty orange head pokes up over the chapbooks in poetry. The cat likes to climb behind a stack and sleep for days, his presence marked only by the emptying dish and the occasional gasp of a customer when they come across a pair of unblinking yellow eyes at the back of the shelves. Book is the only one who's been at the bookstore longer than Henry. He's worked there for the last 5 years, having started back when he was still a grad student in theology. At first, it was just a part-time gig, a way to supplement the university stipend, but then school went away and the store stayed.
Henry knows he should probably get another job because the pay is shit and he has 21 years of expensive formal education. And then, of course, there's his brother David's voice, which sounds exactly like their father's voice, calmly asking where this job leads, if this is really how he plans to spend his life. But Henry doesn't know what else to do, and he can't bring himself to leave. It's the only thing he hasn't failed out of yet. And the truth is, Henry loves the store, loves the smell of books and the steady weight of them on shelves, the presence of old titles and the arrival of new ones, and the fact that in a city like New York, there will always be readers. Bea insists that everyone who works in a bookstore wants to be a writer, but Henry's never fancied himself a novelist. Sure, he's tried putting pen to paper, but it never really works. He can't find the words, the story, the voice. Can't figure out what he could possibly add to so many shelves. Henry would rather be a story keeper than a storyteller. He turns off the lights and grabs the ticket and his coat and heads over to Robbie's show. Henry didn't have time to change. The show starts at 7, and the last word closed at 6, and anyways, he isn't sure what the dress code is for an off-off-Broadway show about fairies in the Bowery, so he's still in dark jeans and a tattered sweater. It's what Bea likes to call librarian chic, even though he doesn't work in a library, a fact she cannot seem to grasp. Bea, on the other hand, looks painfully fashionable, as she always does, with a white blazer rolled up to her elbows, thin silver bands wrapped around her fingers and shining in her ears, thick dreads coiled in a crown atop her head. Henry wonders, as they wait in the queue, if some people have natural style, or if they simply have the discipline to curate themselves every day. They shuffle forward, presenting their tickets at the door. The play is one of those strange medleys of theater and modern dance that only exist in a place like New York. According to Robbie, it's loosely based on A Midsummer Night's Dream, if someone had filed Shakespeare's cadence smooth and cranked up the saturation. Bea knocks him in the ribs. "Did you see the way she looked at you?" He blinks.
"What? Who?"
Bea rolls her eyes.
"You are entirely hopeless."
The lobby bustles around them, and they're wading through the crowd when another person catches Henry's arm. A girl, wrapped in a tattered bohemian dress, green paint flourishes like abstract vines on her temples and cheeks, marking her as one of the actors of the show. He's seen the remnants on Robbie's skin a dozen times in the last few weeks. She holds up a paintbrush and a bowl of gold.
"You're not adorned,"
she says, with sober sincerity, and before he can think to stop her, she paints gold dust on his cheeks, the brush's touch feather light. This close, he can see that faint shimmer in the girl's eyes. Henry tips his chin.
"How do I look?"
he asks, affecting a model's pout, and even though he's joking, the girl flashes him an earnest smile and says,
"Perfect."
A shiver rolls through him at the word, and he is somewhere else, a hand holding his in the dark, a thumb brushing his cheek, but he shakes it off. Bea lets the girl paint a shining stripe down her nose, a dot of gold on her chin, manages to get in a solid 30 seconds of flirting before bells chime through the lobby, and the artistic sprite vanishes back into the crowd as they continue toward the theater doors. Henry threads his arm through Bea's.
"You don't think I'm perfect, do you?"
She snorts.
"God, no."
And he smiles, despite himself, as another actor, a dark-skinned man with rose gold on his cheeks, hands them each a branch, the leaves too green to be real. His gaze lingers on Henry, kind and sad and shining. They show their tickets to an usher, an old woman, white-haired and barely 5 feet tall, and she holds on to Henry's arm for balance as she shows them to their row, pats his elbow when she leaves them, murmuring,
"Such a good boy,"
as she toddles up the aisle. Henry looks at the number on his ticket, and they sidestep over to their seats, a group of three near the middle of the row. Henry sits, Bea on one side, the empty seat on the other. The seat reserved for Tabitha, Because, of course, they'd bought their tickets months ago, when they were still together, when everything was a plural instead of a singular. A dull ache fills Henry's chest, and he wishes he'd paid the $10 for a drink. The lights go down, and the curtain goes up on a kingdom of neon and spray-painted steel, and there is Robbie in the middle of it all, lounging on a throne in a pose that is pure Goblin King. His hair curls up in a high wave, streaks of purple and gold carving the lines of his face into something stunning and strange. And when he smiles, it is easy to remember how Henry fell in love. Back when they were 19, a tangle of lust and loneliness and far-off dreams. And when Robbie speaks, his voice is crystal, reflecting across the theater. "This," he says, "is a story of gods." The stage fills with players, the music begins, and for a while, it is easy. For a while, the world falls away, and everything quiets around them, and Henry disappears. Toward the end of the play, there is a scene that will press itself into the dark of Henry's mind, exposed like light on film. Robbie, the Bowery King, rises from his throne as rain falls in a single sheet across the stage, and even though, moments earlier, it was crowded with people, now, somehow, there is only Robbie. He reaches out, hand skimming the curtain of rain, and it parts around his fingers, his wrist, his arm, as he moves forward inch by inch until his whole body is beneath the wave. He tips his head back, the rain rinsing gold and glitter from his skin, flattening the perfect wave of curls against his skull, erasing all traces of magic, turning him from a languid, arrogant prince into a boy, mortal, vulnerable, alone. The lights go out, and for a long moment, the only sound in the theater is the rain, fading from a solid wall to the steady rhythm of a downpour, and after, to the soft patter of drops on the stage. And then, at last, nothing. The lights come up, and the cast takes the stage, and everyone applauds. Bee cheers and looks at Henry, the joy bleeding from her face. "What's wrong?" she asks. "You look like you're about to faint." He swallows, shakes his head. His hand is throbbing, and when he looks down, he's dug his nails into the scar along his palm, drawing a fresh line of blood. "Henry?"
"I'm fine," he says, wiping his hand on the velvet seat. It was good."
He stands and follows B out. The crowd thins until it's mostly friends and family waiting for the actors to reappear. But Henry feels the eyes, attention drifting like a current. Everywhere he looks, he finds a friendly face, a warm smile, and sometimes more. Finally, Robbie comes bounding into the lobby and throws his arms around both of them. "My adoring fans," he says, in a thespian's ringing alto. Henry snorts, and B holds out a chocolate rose, a long inside joke since Robbie once bemoaned that you had to choose between chocolates and flowers, and B pointed out that that was Valentine's Day, and that for performances, flowers were typical, and Robbie said he wasn't typical, and besides, what if he was hungry?
"You were great," says Henry, and it's true. Robbie is great. He's always been great. That trifecta of dance, music, and theater required to get work in New York. He's still a few streets off Broadway, but Henry has no doubt he'll get there. He runs his hand through Robbie's hair. Dry, it is the color of burnt sugar, a tawny shade somewhere between brown and red, depending on the light. But right now, it's still wet from the final scene, and for a second, Robbie leans in to the touch, resting the weight of his head in Henry's hand. His chest tightens, and he has to remind his heart it is not real, not anymore. Henry pats his friend's back, and Robbie straightens, as if revived, renewed. He holds his rose aloft like a baton and announces, "To the party!"
Henry used to think that after parties were only for last shows, a way for the cast to say goodbye. But he's since learned that for theater kids, every performance is an excuse to celebrate, to come down from the high, or in the case of Robbie's crowd, to keep it going. It's almost midnight, and they're packed into a third-floor walk-up in Soho, the lights low and someone's playlist pumping through a pair of wireless speakers. The cast moves through the center like a vein, their faces still painted, but their costumes shed, caught between their onstage characters and their offstage selves. Henry drinks a lukewarm beer and rubs his thumb along the scar on his palm, in what's quickly becoming a habit. For a while, he had B to keep him company. B, who much prefers dinner parties to theater ones, place settings and dialogues to plastic cups and lines shouted over stereos. A groaning compatriot, huddled with Henry in the corner, studying the tapestry of actors as if they were in one of her art history books. But then another Bowery sprite whisked her away, and Henry shouted "Traitor!" in their wake, even though he was glad to see Bea happy again. Meanwhile, Robbie is dancing in the middle of the room, always the center of the party. He gestures for Henry to join him, but Henry shakes his head, ignoring the pull, the easy draw of gravity, the open arms waiting at the end of the fall. At his worst, they were a perfect match, the differences between them purely gravitational. Robbie, who always managed to stay alight, while Henry came crashing down. "Hey, handsome." Henry turns, looking up from his beer, and sees one of the leads from the show, a stunning girl with rust-red lips and a white lily crown, the gold glitter on her cheeks stenciled to look like graffiti. She is looking at him with such open want, he should feel wanted, should feel something besides sad, lonely, lost. "Drink with me." Her blue eyes shine as she holds out a little tray, a pair of shots with something small and white dissolving on the bottom. Henry thinks of all the stories about accepting food and drink from the Fae, even as he reaches for the glass. He drinks, and at first, all he tastes is sweetness, the faint burn of tequila. But then, the world begins to fuzz a little at the edges. He wants to feel lighter, to feel brighter, but the room darkens, and he can feel a storm creeping in. He was 12 when the first one rolled through. He didn't see it coming. One day, the skies were blue, and the next, the clouds were low and dense, and the next, the wind was up and it was pouring rain. It would be years before Henry learned to think of those dark times as storms, to believe that they would pass if he could simply hold on long enough. His parents meant well, of course, but they always told him things like "cheer up," or "it will get better," or worse, "it's not that bad." Which is easy to say when you've never had a day of rain. Henry's oldest brother, David, is a doctor, but he still doesn't understand. His sister Muriel says she does, that all artists suffer through their storms, before offering him a pill from the mint container she keeps in her purse. Her little pink umbrellas, she calls them, playing on his metaphor, as if it's just a clever turn of phrase and not the way Henry can try to make them understand what it's like inside his head. It is just a storm, he thinks again, even as he pulls away from the scene, makes some excuse about going to find air. The party is too warm, and he wants to be outside, wants to go onto the roof and look up and see there is no bad weather, only stars. But of course there are no stars, not in Soho. He makes it halfway down the hall before he stops, remembering the show, the sight of Robbie in the rain, and shivers, deciding to go down instead of up, deciding to go home. And he's almost to the door when she catches his hand. The girl with ivy curling over her skin, the one who painted him gold. "It's you," she says.
"It's you," he says.
She reaches out and wipes a fleck of gold from Henry's cheek, and the contact is like static shock, a spark of energy where skin meets skin.
"Don't go," she says.
And he's still trying to think of what to say next when she pulls him close and he kisses her, quick, searching, breaks off when he hears her gasp. "Sorry,"
he says, the word automatic, like please, like thank you, like I'm fine. But she reaches up and grabs a handful of his curls.
What for?
She asks, drawing his mouth back to hers.
Are you sure?
He murmurs, even though he knows what she will say, because he's already seen the light in her eyes, the pale clouds sweeping through her vision.
Is this what you want?
He wants the truth, but there is no truth for him, not anymore, and the girl just smiles and draws him back against the nearest door.
This, she says, is exactly what I want.
And then they're in one of the bedrooms, the door clicking shut and blotting out the noises of the party beyond the wall, and her mouth is on his, and he cannot see her eyes now in the dark, so it's easy to believe that this is real. And for a while, Henry disappears. New York City, March 12th, 2014. 2. Addie makes her way uptown, reading The Odyssey by streetlight. It's been a while since she read anything in Greek, but the poetic cadence of the epic poem draws her back into the stride of the old language, and by the time the Baxter comes into sight, she is half lost in the image of the ship at sea, looking forward to a glass of wine and a hot bath, and destined for neither. Her timing is either very good or very bad, depending on how you look at it, because Addie rounds the corner onto 56th just as a black sedan pulls up in front of the Baxter and James St. Clair steps out onto the curb. He's back from his filming, tan and seemingly happy, wearing a pair of sunglasses despite the fact it's after dark. Addie slows and stops. Hovers across the street as the doorman helps him unload and carry his bags inside. Shit, she mutters under her breath as the night dissolves. No bubble baths, no bottles of Merlot. She sighs and retreats to the intersection, trying to decide what to do next. To her left, Central Park unravels like a dark green cloth in the center of the city. To her right, Manhattan rises in jagged lines, block after block of crowded buildings from Midtown down to the Financial District. She goes right, making her way down toward the East Village. Her stomach begins to growl, and on second, she catches sight of dinner. A young man on a bicycle dismounts on the curb, unpacks an order from the zippered case behind the seat, and jogs the plastic bag up to the building. Addie drifts up to the bike and reaches in. It's Chinese, she guesses, going by the size and shape of the containers, the paper edges folded and bound with thin metal handles. She plucks out a carton and a pair of disposable chopsticks and slips away before the man at the door has even paid. There was a time she felt guilty about stealing, but the guilt, like so many things, has worn away, and even though the hunger can't kill her, it still hurts as though it will. Addie makes her way toward Avenue C, scooping lo mein into her mouth as her legs carry her through the village to a brick building with a green door. She dumps the empty carton in a trash can on the corner and reaches the building entrance just as a man is coming out. She smiles at him, and he smiles back and holds the door. Inside, she climbs four flights of narrow steps to a steel door at the top, reaches up, and feels along the dusty frame for the small silver key, discovered last fall, when she and a lover stumbled home, the two a tangle of limbs on the stairs, Sam's lips pressed beneath her jaw, paint-streaked fingers sliding beneath the waistband of her jeans. It was, for Sam, a rare, impulsive moment. It was, for Addie, the second month of an affair. A passionate affair, to be sure, but only because time is a luxury she can't afford. Sure, she dreams of sleepy mornings over coffee, legs draped across a lap, inside jokes and easy laughter, but those comforts come with the knowing. There can be no slow build, no quiet lust, intimacy fostered over days, weeks, months. Not for them. So she longs for the mornings, but she settles for the nights. And if it cannot be love, well, then, at least it is not lonely. Her fingers close around the key, the metal scraping softly as she drags it from its hiding spot. It takes 3 tries in the rusted old lock, just like it did that first night, but then the door swings open and she steps out onto the building's roof. A breeze kicks up, and she shoves her hands in the pocket of her leather jacket as she crosses the roof. It's empty, save for a trio of lawn chairs, each of them imperfect in its own way, seats warped, stuck in different poses of recline, one arm hanging at a broken angle. A stained cooler sits nearby, and a string of fairy lights hangs between laundry posts, transforming the roof into a shabby, weather-worn oasis. It's quiet up here. Not silent, that is a thing she's yet to find in a city, a thing she is beginning to think lost amid the weeds of the old world, but as quiet as it gets in this part of Manhattan. And yet, it is not the same kind of quiet that stifled her at James's place, not the empty, internal quiet of places too big for one. It is a living quiet, full of distant shouts and car horns and stereo bass reduced to an ambient static. A low brick wall surrounds the roof, and Addie lets herself lean forward against it, resting her elbows and looking out until the building falls away, and all she can see is the lights of Manhattan, tracing patterns against the vast and starless sky. Addie misses stars. She met a boy back in 65, and when she told him that, he drove her an hour outside of LA just to see them. The way his face glowed with pride when he pulled over in the dark and pointed up. Addie had craned her head and looked at the meager offering, the spare string of lights across the sky, and felt something in her sag. A heavy sadness, like loss. And for the first time in a century, she longed for Villon, for home, for a place where the stars were so bright they formed a river, a stream of silver and purple light against the dark. She looks up now, over the rooftops, and wonders if, after all this time, the darkness is still watching, even though it has been so long. Even though he told her once that he doesn't keep track of every life, pointed out that the world was big and full of souls, and he had far more to occupy himself than thoughts of her. The rooftop door crashes open behind her, and a handful of people stumble out. 2 guys, 2 girls, and Sam. Wrapped in a white sweater and pale gray jeans, her body like a brushstroke, long and lean and bright against the backdrop of the darkened roof. Her hair is longer now, wild blonde curls escaping a messy bun. Streaks of red paint dab her forearms where the sleeves are pushed up, and Addie wonders, almost absently, what she's working on. She is a painter, abstracts mostly. Her place, already small, made smaller by the stacks of canvas propped against the walls. Her name, crisp and easy, only Samantha on her finished work, or when traced across a spine in the middle of the night. The other 4 move in a huddle of noise across the roof, one of the guys in the middle of a story, but Sam lags behind a step, head tipped back to savor the crisp night air. And Addie wishes she had something else to stare at, an anchor to keep her from falling into the easy gravity of the other girl's orbit. She does, of course, the Odyssey. Addie is about to bury her gaze in the book when Sam's blue eyes dip down from the sky and find her own. The painter smiles, and for an instant, it is August again, and they are laughing over beers on a bar patio, Addie lifting the hair off her neck to calm the flush of summer heat, Sam leaning in to blow on her skin. It is September, and they are in her unmade bed, their fingers tangled in the sheets and with each other, as Addie's mouth traces the dark warmth between Sam's legs. Addie's heart slams in her chest as the girl peels away from her group and casually wanders over.
Sorry for crashing your piece.
Oh, I don't mind, says Addie, forcing her gaze out as if studying the city, even though Sam always made her feel like a sunflower, unconsciously angling toward the other girl's light.
These days, everyone's looking down, muses Sam. It's nice to see someone looking up.
Time slides. It's the same thing Sam said the first time they met, and the sixth, and the tenth. But it's not just a line. Sam has an artist's eye, present, searching, the kind that studies their subject and sees something more than shapes. Addie turns away, waits for the sound of retreating steps, but instead, she hears the snap of a lighter, and then Sam is beside her, a white blonde curl dancing at the edge of her sight. She gives in, glances over. "Could I steal one of those?" she asks, nodding at the cigarette. Sam smiles. "You could, but you don't need to." She draws another from the box and hands it over, along with a neon blue lighter. Addie takes them, tucks the cigarette between her lips, and drags her thumb along the starter. Luckily, the breeze is up, and she has an excuse, watching the flame as it goes out. Goes out. Goes out. Goes out. "Here." Sam steps closer, her shoulder brushing Addie's as she steps in to block the wind. She smells like the chocolate chip cookies that her neighbor bakes whenever she's stressed, like the lavender soap she uses to scrub paint from her fingers, the coconut conditioner she leaves in her curls at night. Addie has never loved the taste of tobacco, but the smoke warms her chest, and it gives her something to do with her hands, a thing to focus on besides Sam. They're so close, breaths fogging the same bit of air, and then Sam reaches out and touches one of the freckles on Addie's right cheek, the way she did the first time they met, a gesture so simple and still so intimate. "You have stars," she says, and Addie's chest tightens, twists again.
Déjà vu, déjà su, déjà vécu.
She has to fight the urge to close the gap, to run her palm along the long slope of Sam's neck, to let it rest against the nape where Addie knows it fits so well. They stand in silence, blowing out clouds of pale smoke, the other four laughing and shouting at their backs until one of the guys, Eric, Aaron, calls Sam over, and just like that, she is slipping away, back across the roof. Addie fights the urge to tighten her grip instead of letting go, again. But she does. Leans against the low brick wall and listens to them talk about life, about getting old, about bucket lists and bad decisions, and then one of the girls says, "Shit, we're gonna be late." And just like that, beers get finished, cigarettes put out, and the group of them drifts back toward the rooftop door, all five retreating like a tide. Sam is the last to go. She slows, glances over her shoulder, flashing a last smile at Addie before she ducks inside. And Addie knows she could catch her if she runs, could beat the closing door. She doesn't move. The metal bangs shut. Addie sags against the brick wall. Being forgotten, she thinks, is a bit like going mad. You begin to wonder what is real, if you are real. After all, how can a thing be real if it cannot be remembered? It's like that Zen koan, the one about the tree falling in the woods. If no one heard it, did it happen? If a person cannot leave a mark, do they exist? Addie stubs the cigarette out on the brick ledge and turns her back on the skyline, makes her way to the broken chairs and the cooler wedged between them. She finds a single beer floating amid the half-frozen melt and twists off the cap, sinking onto the least damaged lawn chair. It is not so cold tonight, and she is too tired to go looking for another bed. The glow of the fairy lights is just enough to see by, and Addie stretches out in the lawn chair and opens the Odyssey and reads of strange lands and monsters and men who can't ever go home until the cold lulls her to sleep. Paris, France, August 9th, 1714. 3. Heat hangs like a low roof over Paris. The August air is heavy, made heavier still by the sprawl of stone buildings, the reek of rotting food and human refuse, the sheer number of bodies living shoulder to shoulder.
In 150 years, Osman will set his mark upon the city, raise a uniform facade, and paint the buildings in the same pale palette, creating a testament to art and evenness and beauty. That is the kind of Paris Addie dreamed of, and one she will certainly live to see. But right now, the poor pile themselves in ragged heaps while silk-finished nobles stroll through gardens. The streets are crowded with horse-drawn carts, the squares thick with people, and here and there spires thrust up through the woolen fabric of the city. Wealth parades down avenues and rises with the peaks of each palace and estate, while hovels cluster in narrow roads, the stones stained dark with grime and smoke. Addie is too overwhelmed to notice any of it. She skirts the edge of a square, watching as men dismantle market stalls and kick out at the ragged children who duck and weave between them, searching for scraps. As she walks, her hand slips into the hem pocket of her skirts, past the little wooden bird, to the 4 copper sol she found in the lining of the stolen coat. 4 sol to make a life. It is getting late and threatening to rain, and she must find a place to sleep. It should be easy enough. There is, it seems, a lodging house on every street, but she is hardly across the threshold of the first when she is turned away.
"This is no brothel,"
chides the owner, glaring down his nose.
"And I'm no whore,"
she answers. But he only sneers and flicks his fingers as if casting off some unwanted residue. The second house is full, the third too costly, the fourth harbors only men. By the time she steps through the doors of the fifth, the sun has set, and her spirits with it, and she is already braced for the rebuke, some excuse as to why she is unfit to stay beneath the roof. But she isn't turned away. An older woman meets her in the entry, thin and stiff, with a long nose and the small, sharp eyes of a hawk. She takes one look at Addie and leads her down the hall. The rooms are small and dingy, but they have walls and doors, a window and a bed.
"A week's pay," demands the woman. "In advance."
Addie's heart sinks. A week seems an impossible stretch when memories only seem to last a moment, an hour, a day.
"Well," snaps the woman.
Addie's hand closes around the copper coins. She is careful to draw out only 3, and the woman snatches them as fast as a crow stealing crusts of bread. They vanish into the pouch at her waist.
"Can you give me a bill?" asks Addie. "Some proof to show I've paid?"
The woman scowls, clearly insulted.
"I run an honest house."
"I'm sure you do," fumbles Addie. "But you have so many rooms to keep. It would be easy to forget which ones have..."
34 years I've run this lodge," she cuts in, "and never yet forgotten a face."
It is a cruel joke, thinks Addie, as the woman turns and shuffles away, leaving her to her rented room. A week she paid for, but she knows that she will be lucky to have a day, knows that in the morning she will be evicted, the matron 3 crowns richer, while she herself will be out on the street. A little bronze key rests in the lock, and Addie turns it, relishes the solid sound, like a stone dropped into a stream. She has nothing to unpack, no change of clothes. She casts off the traveling coat, draws the little wooden bird from her skirts, and sets it on the windowsill, a talisman against the dark. She looks out, expecting to see Paris's grand rooftops and dazzling buildings, the tall spires, or at least the Seine. But she has walked too far from the river, and the little window looks out only onto a narrow alleyway and the stone wall of another house that could be anywhere. Addie's father told her so many stories of Paris, made it sound like a place of glamour and gold, rich with magic and dreams waiting to be uncovered. Now she wonders if he ever saw it, or if the city was nothing but a name, an easy backdrop for princes and knights, adventurers and queens. They have bled together in her mind, those stories, become less a picture than a palette, a tone. Perhaps the city was less splendid. Perhaps there were shadows mixed in with the light.
It is a gray and humid night, the sounds of merchants and horse carts muted by the soft rain beginning to fall, and Addie curls up on the narrow bed and tries to sleep. She thought at least she'd have the night, but the rain hasn't even stopped, the darkness barely settled, when the woman bangs upon her door and a key is thrust into the lock and the tiny room is plunged into noise. Rough hands haul Addie from the bed. A man grips her arm as the woman sneers and says,
"Who let you in?"
Addie fights to wipe away the dregs of sleep.
"You did," she says, wishing the woman had only swallowed her pride and given a receipt.
But all Addie has is the key, and before she can show it, the woman's bony hand cuts hard across her cheek.
"Don't lie, girl," she says, sucking her teeth. "This isn't a charity house."
"I paid," says Addie, cupping her face, but it is no use.
The three soul in the pouch at the woman's waist will not serve as proof.
"We spoke, you and I. 34 years you said you've run this house."
For an instant, uncertainty flashes across the woman's face, but it is too brief, too fleeting. Addie will one day learn to ask for secrets, details only a friend or intimate would know, but even then it will not always gain their favor. She will be called a trickster, a witch, a spirit, and a madwoman, will be cast out for a dozen different reasons, when in truth there is only one. They don't remember.
"Out,"
orders the woman, and Addie barely has time to grab her coat before she's forced from the room. Halfway down the hall, she remembers the wooden bird still resting on the windowsill and tries to twist free to go back for it, but the man's grip is firm. She's cast out onto the street, shaking from the sudden violence of it all. The only consolation that before the door swings shut, the little wooden bird is tossed out too. It lands on the stones beside her, one wing cracking with the force. Though this time, the bird doesn't mend itself. It lies there beside her, a sliver of wood chipped off like a fallen feather as the woman vanishes back inside the house. And Addie stifles the horrible urge to laugh. Not at the humor, but the madness of it, the absurd, inevitable ending to her night. It is very late, or very early, the city quieted and the sky a cloudy, rain-slicked gray. But she knows the dark is watching as she scoops up the carving, buries it in her pocket with the last copper coin, gets to her feet, drawing the coat tight around her shoulders, the hem of her skirts already damp. Exhausted, Addie makes her way down the narrow street and takes shelter beneath the wooden lip of an awning, sinking down into the stone crook between buildings to wait for dawn. She slips into a feverish almost sleep and feels her mother's hand against her brow, the faint rise and fall of her voice as she hums, smoothing a blanket over Addie's shoulders. And she knows she must be ill. That is the only time she saw her mother gentle. Addie lingers there, holding fast to the memory even as it fades, the harsh clop of hooves and strain of wooden carts encroaching on her mother's whispering song, burying it note by note until she jerks forward out of the haze. Her skirts are stiff with grime, stained and wrinkled from the brief but restless sleep. The rain has stopped, but the city looks just as dirty as it did on her arrival. Back home, a good storm would wash the world clean, leave it smelling crisp and new. But it seems nothing can rinse the grime from the streets of Paris. If anything, that storm has only made things worse, the world wet and dull, puddles brown with mud and filth. And then, amid the muck, she smells something sweet. She follows the scent until she finds a market in full swing, the vendors shouting prices from tables and stalls, chickens still squawking as they're hauled off the backs of carts. Addie is famished, cannot even remember the last time she ate. Her dress doesn't fit, but it never did. She'd stolen it from a washing line 2 days outside of Paris, tired of the one she'd worn the day of her wedding. Still, it hangs no looser now, despite the days without food or drink. She supposes she does not need to eat, will not perish from hunger. But tell that to her cramping stomach, her shaking legs.
She scans the busy square, thumbs the last coin in her pocket, loath to spend it. Perhaps she does not need to. With so many people in the market, it should be easy to steal what she needs. Or so she thinks. But the merchants of Paris are as cunning as its thieves. They keep twice as tight a grip on every ware. Addie learns this the hard way. It will be weeks before she learns to palm an apple, longer still to master it without the faintest tell. Today, she makes a clumsy effort, tries to swipe a seeded roll from a bread baker's cart, and is rewarded with a meaty hand viced around her wrist.
Thief!
She catches a glimpse of men at arms weaving through the crowd and is flooded with the fear of landing in a cell or stock. She is still flesh and bone, has not yet learned to pick locks or charm men out of charges, to free herself from shackles as easily as her face slips from their minds. So she pleads hastily, handing over her last coin. He plucks it from her, waves the men away as the soul vanishes into his purse. Far too much for a roll, but he gives her nothing back. Payment, he says, for trying to steal.
Lucky I don't take your fingers,
he growls, pushing her away. And that is how Addie comes to be in Paris, with a crust of bread and a broken bird and nothing else. She hurries from the market, slowing only when she reaches the bank of the Seine. And then, breathless, she tears into the roll, tries to make it last, but in moments it is gone, like a drop of water down an empty well, her hunger barely touched. She thinks of Estelle. The year before, the old woman developed a ringing in her ears. It was always there, she said, day and night, and when Addie asked her how she could bear the constant noise, she shrugged.
With time, she said, you can get used to anything.
But Addie does not think she will ever get used to this. She stares out at the boats on the river, the cathedral rising through the curtain of mist, the glimpses of beauty that shine like gems against the dingy setting of the blocks, too far away and flat to be real. She stands there until she realizes she is waiting, waiting for someone to help, to come and fix the mess she's in. But no one is coming. No one remembers. And if she resigns herself to waiting, she will wait forever. So she walks. And as she walks, she studies Paris. Makes a note of this house and that road, of bridges and carriage horses and the gates of a garden. Glimpses roses beyond the wall. Beauty in the cracks. It will take years for her to learn the workings of this city, to memorize the clockwork of arrondissement step by step, chart the course of every vendor, shop, and street, to study the nuances of the neighborhoods and find the strongholds and the cracks, learn to survive and thrive in the spaces between other people's lives, make a place for herself among them. Eventually, Addie will master Paris. She will become a flawless thief, uncatchable and quick. She will slip through fine houses like a filigreed ghost, move through salons, and steal up onto rooftops at night and drink pilfered wine beneath the open sky. She will smile and laugh at every stolen victory. Eventually, but not today. Today, she is simply trying to distract herself from her gnawing hunger and her stifling fear. Today, she is alone in a strange city with no money and no past and no future. Someone dumps a bucket from a second floor window without warning, and thick brown water splashes onto the cobbles at her feet. Addie jumps back, trying to avoid the worst of the splash, only to collide with a pair of women in fine dresses who look at her as if she were a stain. Addie retreats, sinking onto a nearby step, but moments later, a woman comes out and shakes a broom, accuses her of trying to steal away her customers.
Go to the docks if you plan to sell your wares, she scolds.
And at first, Addie doesn't know what the woman means. Her pockets are empty. She's nothing to sell. But when she says as much, the woman gives her such a look and says,
you've got a body, don't you?
Her face flushes as she understands.
I'm not a whore, she says,
and the woman flashes a cold smirk.
Aren't we proud?
She says as Addie rises, turns to go.
Well,
the woman calls after in a crow-like caw,
that pride won't fill your belly.
Addie pulls the coat tight around her shoulders and forces her legs forward down the road, feeling as if they're about to fold when she sees the open doors of a church. Not the grand, imposing towers of Notre Dame, but a small stone thing squeezed between buildings on a narrow street. She has never been religious, not like her parents. She has always felt caught between the old gods and the new, but meeting the devil in the woods has got her thinking. For every shadow, there must be light. Perhaps the darkness has an equal, and Addie could balance her wish. Estelle would sneer, but one god gave her nothing but a curse, so the woman cannot fault her for seeking shelter with the other. The heavy door scrapes open, and she shuffles in, blinking in the sudden dark until her eyes adjust and she sees the panels of stained glass. Addie inhales, struck by the quiet beauty of the space, the vaulted ceiling, the red and blue and green light painting patterns on the walls. It is a kind of art, she thinks, starting forward, when a man steps into her path. He opens his arms, but there is no welcome in the gesture. The priest is there to bar her way. He shakes his head at her arrival.
I'm sorry, he says, coaxing her like a stray bird back up the aisle. There is no room here. We're full.
And then she is back out on the steps of the church, the heavy grind of the bolt sliding home, and somewhere in Addie's mind, Estelle begins to cackle.
You see, she says in her rasping way, only new gods have locks.
Addie never decides to go to the docks. Her feet choose for her, carry her along the Seine as the sun sinks over the river, lead her down the steps, stolen boots thudding on the wooden planks. It's darker there, in the shadow of the ships, a landscape of crates and barrels, ropes and rocking boats. Eyes follow her. Men glance over from their work, and women look on, lounging like cats in the shade. They have a sickly look about them, their color too high, their mouths painted a violent gash of red, their dresses tattered and dirty, and still finer than Addie's own. She has not decided what she means to do, even when she slips the coat from her shoulders, even when a man comes up to her, one hand already roving as if testing fruit.
How much?
He asks in a gruff voice, and she has no idea what a body is worth, or if she is willing to sell it. When she does not answer, his hands grow rough, his grip grows firm.
10 sol,
she says, and the man lets out a bark of laughter.
What are you, a princess?
No, she answers, a virgin.
There were nights back home when Addie dreamed of pleasure, when she conjured the stranger beside her in the dark, felt his lips against her breasts, imagined her hand was his as it slipped between her legs. My love, the stranger said, pressing her down into the bed, black curls tumbling into gem green eyes. My love, she breathed as he entered her, her body parting around his solid strength. He pushed deeper, and she gasped, biting her hand to keep from sighing too loud. Her mother would say that a woman's pleasure was a mortal sin, but in those moments, Addie didn't care. In those moments, there was only the longing and the want and the stranger whispering against her skin as the tension deepened, the heat building like a storm in the bowl of her hips, and then, in her mind, Adeline would pull his body down on hers, drawing him deeper and deeper until the storm broke and thunder rolled through her. But this is nothing like that. There is no poetry to this unknown man's grunts, no melody or harmony, save the steady noise of thrusting as he pushes himself against her, no rolling pleasure, only pressure and pain,
the tightness of one thing being forced inside another, and Addie looks up at the night sky so she won't have to look at his body moving, and she feels the darkness looking back. Then they are in the woods again, and his mouth is on hers, blood bubbling up on her lips as he whispers, "Done." The man finishes with a final thrust and slumps against her, leaden, and this cannot be it. This cannot be the life Addie traded everything for. This cannot be the future that erased her past. Panic grips her chest, but this stranger doesn't seem to care or even notice. He simply straightens up and tosses a handful of coins onto the cobbles at her feet. He trundles off, and Addie sinks to her knees to collect her reward, and then empties her stomach into the Seine. When asked about her first memories of Paris, those terrible few months, she will say it was a season of grief blurred into a fog. She will say she can't remember, but of course Addie remembers. She remembers the stench of rotten food and waste, the brackish waters of the Seine, the figures on the dock, remembers moments of kindness erased by a doorway or a dawn, remembers mourning her home with its fresh bread and warm hearth, her family's quiet melody, and Estelle's strong beat. The life she had, the one she gave up for the one she thought she wanted, stolen and replaced by this. And yet, she remembers, too, how she marveled at the city, the way the light swept through in the mornings and evenings, the grandeur carved out between the unhewn blocks, how, despite all the grime and grief and disappointment, Paris was full of surprises. Beauty glimpsed through cracks. Addie remembers the brief respite of that first fall, the brilliant turning of leaves over footpaths, going from green to gold like a jeweler's showcase before the short, sharp plunge into winter. Remembers the cold that gnawed at her fingers and toes before swallowing them whole. Cold and hunger. They had lean months in Villon, of course, when the cold snap stole the last of a harvest or a late freeze ruined new growth. But this is a new kind of hunger. It rakes at her from the inside, drags its nails along her ribs. It wears her down. And while Addie knows it cannot kill her, the knowing does nothing to dull the urgent ache, the fear. She has not lost an ounce of flesh, but her stomach twists, gnawing on itself. And just as her feet refuse to callous, so her nerves refuse to learn. There is no numbing. None of the ease that comes with a habit. This pain is always fresh, brittle, and bright, the feeling as sharp as her memory. And she remembers the worst, too. Remembers the sudden freeze, the brutal chill that stole upon the city, and the waves of sickness that blew in behind it like a late fall breeze, scattering mounds of dead and dying leaves. The sound and sight of the carts rattling past, carrying grim cargo. Addie, turning her face away, trying not to look at the bony shapes piled carelessly in the back. She pulls a stolen coat close around her as she stumbles down the road and dreams of summer heat while the cold climbs down into her bones. She does not think she will ever be warm again. Twice more she has gone to the docks, but the cold has forced the collars in, to the warm shelters of brothels, and around her the cold snap has turned Paris cruel. The rich board themselves up inside their homes, cling to their hearth fires, while out in the streets the poor are whittled down by winter. There is nowhere to hide from it, or rather, the only spots have all been claimed. That first year, Addie is too tired to fight for space. Too tired to search for shelter. Another gust whips through, and Addie folds herself against it, eyes blurring. She shuffles sideways onto a narrow street just to escape the violent wind, and the sudden quiet, the breezeless peace of the alley is like down, soft and warm. Her knees fold. She slumps into a corner against a set of steps and watches her fingers turn blue. Thinks she can see frost spreading over her skin, and marvels quietly, sleepily, at her own transformation. Her breath fogs in the air in front of her, each exhale briefly blotting out the world beyond until the gray city fades to white, to white, to white. Strange how it seems to linger now, a little more with every breath, as if she's fogging up a pane of glass. She wonders how many breaths until the world is hidden, erased, like her. Perhaps it is her vision blurring. She does not care. She is tired. She is so tired. Addie cannot stay awake, and why should she try? Sleep is such a mercy. Perhaps she will wake again in spring, like the princess in one of her father's stories, and find herself lying in the grassy bank along the Saat, Estelle nudging her with a worn shoe and teasing her for dreaming again. This is death. At least for an instant, Addie thinks it must be death. The world is dark, the cold unable to hold back the reek of rot, and she cannot move. But then, she remembers, she cannot die. There is her stubborn pulse, fighting to beat, and her stubborn lungs fighting to fill, and Addie realizes her limbs aren't lifeless at all, but weighted down on every side. Heavy sacks above, below, and panic flutters through her, but her mind is still sluggish with sleep. She twists, and the sacks shift a little on top of her. The dark splits, and a sliver of gray light shines through. Addie writhes and wriggles until she frees one arm and then the other, drawing them in against her body. She begins to push up through the sacks, and only then does she feel bones beneath the cloth. Only then does her hand meet waxy skin. Only then do her fingers tangle in the strands of someone else's hair, and now she is awake, so awake, scrambling, tearing, desperate to get free. She claws her way up and out, hands splayed across the bony mound of a dead man's back. Nearby, milky eyes stare up at her. A jaw hangs open, and Addie stumbles out of the cart and collapses to the ground, retching, sobbing, alive. A horrible sound tears free from her chest, a harsh cough, something snagged halfway between a sob and a laugh. Then, a scream. And it takes a moment for her to realize it is not coming from her own cracked lips. A ragged woman stands across the road, hands to her mouth in horror, and Addie cannot even blame her. What a shock it must be to see a corpse drag itself free from the cart. The woman crosses herself, and Addie calls out in a hoarse and broken voice, "I am not dead!" But the woman only shuffles away, and Addie turns her fury on the cart. "I am not dead," she says again, kicking at the wooden wheel.
"Hey,"
shouts a man, holding the legs of a frail and twisted corpse.
"Stay back,"
shouts a second, gripping its shoulders. Of course, they do not remember throwing her in. Addie backs away as they swing the newest body up into the cart. It lands with a sickening thud atop the others, and her stomach churns to think she was among them, even briefly. A whip cracks, the horses shuffle forward, the wheels turn on the cobbled stones, and it is not until the cart has gone, not until Addie thrusts her trembling hands into the pockets of her stolen coat, that she realizes they are empty. The little wooden bird is gone. The last of her past life carried away with the dead. For months, she will keep reaching for the bird, hand drifting to her pocket the way it might to a stubborn curl, a motion born of so much habit. She cannot seem to remind her fingers it is gone, cannot seem to remind her heart, which stutters a little every time she finds the pocket empty. But there, blooming amid the sorrow, is a terrible relief. Every moment since she left Vion, she has feared the loss of this last token. Now that it is gone, there is a guilty gladness tucked among the grief. This last, brittle thread to her old life has broken, and Addie has been set well and truly and forcibly free.